Sure is good to see everybody this morning. If you would take out your Bibles and turn to 1 Samuel chapter 17. 1 Samuel 17. We're going to be spending most of our time in that chapter today. How many of you have ever heard the story of Dave and the Giant Pickle? Has anybody ever heard that story before? Dave and the Giant Pickle. Some of you have no idea what I'm talking about. A bunch of you do know what I'm talking about. Some of you, in fact, have a movie in your library, whether it's on DVD or like us on an old VHS tape, called Dave and the Giant Pickle. I guess there were these guys a while back that decided they wanted to teach their kids some Bible stories, and they also wanted their kids to eat their vegetables and not hate them. And so they created these things called Veggie Tales, and basically they tell Bible stories with vegetable characters. And I know that sounds awfully weird, but they're really good. I mean, I love them. I think in Dave and the Giant Pickle, if I remember right, Dave is a little asparagus that fights a giant pickle. Maybe he might be a tomato or a cucumber. Maybe it's his dad, Jesse, that's the asparagus. But there's lots of vegetables and lots of fighting. You know, what's interesting to me about most of those stories is if you look at the VeggieTales series, there's Dave and the Giant Pickle, there's Rack, Shack, and Benny, which is Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. There's Josh and the Big Wall, and that's Joshua, and Jericho. But there's all the classic kids' stories that they put to video. I think the problem for me sometimes in my mind is that I start thinking that those stories are just kids' stories. And the truth is they aren't. In fact, if you read them in the Bible, most of the time there's things that you probably want to skip with your kids, that you really don't want to tell the whole story about what's going on because it's pretty graphic. There's some scary things. There's some pretty serious things. But these events in history, more than just being stories, these are there for a reason. They exist to teach profound lessons for life. And kids are great to learn those lessons. But I think sometimes we forget as adults to go back to them and pay attention to what they mean for us. So I intend to do that today with not Dave and the Giant Pickle, but David, the rightful king of Israel, who's still just a boy, fighting against a Philistine champion, probably at the time one of the greatest warriors around, a guy named Goliath. We're going to tell that story in just a minute and draw some lessons from it. But before we do that, let's go ahead and bow our heads, ask God to be with us in the study. Our dearest Father, it is a joy that we get to be together today. Right now, we're going to look into your word, and we're grateful for it that you wrote down through history, through your prophets and your servants, real stories, people who were just like us, who trusted in you and learned lessons that were hard to learn. We're thankful, Father, for the power of those stories, both in the way that they motivate us to be more courageous and to trust you more, but also, Father, in the way that they humble and strengthen us, that we see ourselves with all of our weaknesses because you didn't shy away from telling about theirs. Father, we pray that as we study your word this morning, that you'd be with us in it. Whether we do this or whether we don't, doesn't change anything for you, but we know that it only has value if you bless it and if you're in it. So help us see clearly. Help each one of us that are in this room understand, as we learn from this story, how it applies to us and whatever it is that we're facing in our life, that we'll find the same kind of courage and strength. Father, please bless us. We now pray in Jesus' name. Amen. 1 Samuel chapter 17, verse 1 says, "Now the Philistines gathered their armies for battle." And it talks about where they gather. And if you look at verse 2, it says, "Saul and the men of Israel were gathered and camped in the valley of Elah and drew up in battle array to encounter the Philistines." Now, the scene for this story is a battle. And it's not just a boy and a giant. It's two nations that have come together to fight. And they're nations that had conflict a lot. The Philistines and the Israelites were always going at it. We're going to see that especially to be true during David's reign as he begins to be king. But I want you to imagine for a minute the scene. There's a valley, and I don't know what this valley looked like. When I was in Israel, we didn't go to this place, if they know where this place is. I've heard people say they think they know what valley this was. And there are hills on either side of the valley. And it's kind of an interesting valley. It wasn't a very easy place to fight. It was rocky, if it's the same valley that people think it is. A lot of rocks. It wasn't easy to maneuver. That'll actually maybe become important in the story a little bit later. But that's partly what we see here. Now, the story about David actually starts back in chapter 16. And I want to show you a couple of things there. Go back to verse 1 of chapter 16, and then we'll fast forward back to where we were. It says in verse 1, "Now the Lord said to Samuel, 'How long will you grieve over Saul, since I have rejected him from being king over Israel? Fill your horn with oil and go. I will send you to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have selected a king for myself among his sons.' But Samuel said, 'How can I go? When Saul hears of it, he will kill me.' And the Lord said, 'Take a heifer with you and say, I have come to sacrifice to the Lord. You shall invite Jesse to the sacrifice, and I will show you what you shall do, and you shall anoint for me the one whom I designate to you.'" So it turns out in the story that God is fed up with Saul. And for those of you that know about Israel's history, this is the period of history that we call the United Kingdom. After Israel settled in the Promised Land in the book of Joshua, God for a while delivered them and led them through a series of judges. Samuel's the last of the judges, and we read about him in the story. But the people wanted a king, and so Saul set up his king. God gives him some chances for a while, but then eventually decides that Saul's heart is not with the Lord, and he's rejected him from being king. So he calls Samuel to go anoint a new one. I want you to notice that Samuel's scared about this. He doesn't want to do this. In fact, it sounds like he's still upset that Saul has been rejected, and God gets on his case about that in verse 1. But he's also afraid of Saul. If he goes to anoint a new king, Saul may kill him. And so God designs a sacrifice to be made and says, "I want you to invite Jesse. I'm going to choose the son or the king from one of his sons." Go to verse 6. "When they entered," and this is Jesse's family, "he looked at Eliab," who's the oldest son, "and thought, 'Surely the Lord's anointed is before him.' But the Lord said to Samuel, 'Do not look at his appearance or at the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For God sees not as man sees, for man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart.'" I want you to imagine you're Samuel for a minute. And for a lot of years, you've seen the king of Israel named Saul walk around. And we know something about Saul's physical stature. Do you remember what it says about him? That he was head and shoulders above everybody else. That he was a tall, strong man. Well, Samuel, even as discerning as he was spiritually, I guess got the idea that a king looked that way. So when Eliab walks in and is the tallest and strongest of the brothers, Samuel says, "Surely this is the guy." And by the way, the privilege would typically have been given to the oldest son. And God says, "No, you're wrong about that." I want you to notice verse 7. I think it's very important to the story, even of David and Goliath, when God says that he does not see like men see. That God sees inwardly, men see outwardly. I want you to keep that verse in mind, because we'll come back to it. Well, the next son, verse 8, is named Abinadab. And he comes before Samuel. And God says, well, to Samuel, somehow that's not him either, so Samuel breaks the news to the second son, "It's not you." Well, the next son, verse 9, is named Shammah. and God didn't choose him. And then, if my math is right, four more sons pass before Samuel, and none of them are the king. And so Samuel's a little bit confused because God said, I'm going to choose a king from Jesse's house. And none of these sons measured up. So he asks there in verse 11, Samuel said to Jesse, are these all the children? And he said, well, there remains yet the youngest, and behold, he is tending the sheep. Now, I wonder about this. When Samuel told Jesse to bring his family, did Jesse think, well, it's just too much trouble to go get David wherever he's at in the wilderness and drag him here? Or did Jesse think, there's not a chance in the world that God's going to anoint David? Because David's the youngest, David's just a kid. I mean, surely it's not going to be David. Well, he doesn't even get invited to the party. But I want you to notice that he's the one that God chooses. You know, I think God works like that a lot, don't you? That sometimes who God chooses to use for the greatest demonstrations of his power and strength are through the people that usually don't get invited. Through the people that oftentimes, as far as the world is concerned, don't look like the ones that you'd think. In the New Testament, that principle is said like this: God's power is seen in weakness, or God's strength is seen in weakness. And this is just another example of that. Well, David comes in and he's just a guy. He's good looking, it says, but he's not that tall. He's ruddy, kind of an outdoorsy kid. And this is the one that God chose because David had a heart like God's, according to God. Now, I want you to notice something about this story. David is anointed what? Shepherd? Like the greatest in Jesse's family? No, David is anointed the king of Israel here. Well, so go sit on your throne, right? Not at all. What happens to David now? He goes back to the wilderness to be a shepherd, and the king of Israel is taking care of sheep. I think that's interesting. And I think it's interesting, too, by the way, that there's some providence of God in how David gets to where he is. It turns out that David, I guess, gets bored in the wilderness and likes to play music, and so he's pretty skilled as a musician. And it turns out that Saul, as the Spirit of God departs from Saul, another spirit, a terrorizing spirit, whether that was depression or anger or frustration or whatever it was that gripped Saul in his latter years, he gets to the point where he needs to be soothed somehow. And so somebody tells him that there's a talented musician named David who can play songs that might calm him down. So David ends up being the rightful king of Israel, but serving the defunct king, the king who's not right, the king who David knows, as do a number of others, that he's been rejected as king. And I think that's important in the story. All right, let's go to chapter 17, and let's notice some things about what goes on here. Let's go down to about verse 4. And remember, you've got the two armies standing on either side of the valley. And it says in verse 4, then a champion came out from the armies of the Philistines named Goliath from Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. He had a bronze helmet on his head, and he was clothed with scale armor which weighed 5,000 shekels of bronze. He also had bronze greaves on his legs and a bronze javelin slung between his shoulders. The shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and the head of his spear weighed 600 shekels of iron. His shield carrier also walked before him. He stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel and said to them, why do you come out to draw up in battle array? Am I not the Philistine and you servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will become your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall become our servants and serve us. Again, the Philistine said, I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we might fight together. When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Just make a couple of observations here. Goliath was huge. He was huge. I don't know if any of you watch professional basketball, and you watch all those big guys running around on the court, and you don't really notice it until you see them standing next to somebody who's like me, and then you realize how big those guys are. I don't know if any of you have ever been around somebody that was over 7 foot tall, but that's daunting. Can you imagine a guy who's 9'6", and I don't know what he weighed, I don't know what his muscles looked like, I don't know what his physical stature was like, other than he was big. But it said that he carried around armor on himself. And I don't know if you've ever done the math on this, but the armor that's described there is 125 pounds. Can you imagine that? I mean, that's like, it's not like Claire, it's like Claire and some of Claire, if I was to carry her around on my back. Can you imagine that? The spear was like a weaver's beam. I mean, I couldn't wrap my hand around it. The head of the spear weighed 15 pounds. I don't care how sharp a spear is, if a 15-pound spear hits you, it doesn't have to be sharp. I mean, this is a big guy, and that doesn't include his shin guards. It doesn't include his helmet, and it doesn't include the shield that somebody else had to carry out to battle. I mean, no wonder nobody wanted to fight this guy. So, it's intimidating, and I want you to notice verse 11. Everybody is afraid, including the king, and including Israel's champion, whoever that is. By the way, every nation had a champion. Every nation had a few champions. Every nation, if the champion died, there was somebody else to take his place. That's what armies did. They trained the best fighter for scenes just like this. And that's what Goliath is asking for. Where's the guy that you guys have trained? Where is he? And I'm sure whoever that guy was as far away from the front line as he could be. Hiding in a tent, shaking in his armor, made sure the armor wasn't on so nobody might push him forward, but everybody's afraid. Let's go to verse 12. Now David was the son of the Ephrathite of Bethlehem in Judah, whose name was Jesse, and he had 8 sons. And Jesse was old in the days of Saul, advanced in years among men. The 3 older sons of Jesse had gone after Saul to the battle. And the names of his 3 sons who went to the battle were Eliab, the firstborn, and the 2nd to him, Abinadab, and the 3rd, Shammah. David was the youngest. Now the 3 oldest followed Saul, but David went back and forth from Saul to tend his father's flock at Bethlehem. The Philistines came forward morning and evening for 40 days and took his, or the Philistine came forward morning and evening for 40 days and took his stand. Then Jesse said to David, his son, take now for your brothers an ephah of this roasted grain and these 10 loaves and run to the camp to your brothers. Bring also the ten cuts of cheese to the commander of their 1,000 and look into the welfare of your brothers and bring back news of them. For Saul and they and all the men of Israel are in the valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines. Stop there if you would. I want to just make an observation about this. David's oldest brothers are in battle. Jesse is trying to take care of the brothers or his sons, and so he sends them some food, but he also tells David to bring cheese to the commander of the 1,000. Might that have been one of the champions, by the way? I want you to notice that when David comes into the camp, he's not only going to see his brothers, he's going to have an audience with one of the champions of Israel, and he's going to hand him cheese. What a weird scene that is. The king of Israel handing a commander cheese. Isn't that odd? And it says that David was going back and forth from the wilderness to Saul. Who's David again? He's the king of Israel. And he's being a gopher, isn't he? Hey, David, get me this. Hey, David, go there. Hey, David, serve me. Hey, David. And what do we see with David? Is he all right with it? Sure he is. David's got a character that isn't like a lot of people's. Somebody who's finally been told, hey, you're the guy in charge, you're the king, you've got something special now. Most people I know, including myself, might stand up and say, you know what? Then give me what I deserve. I'm tired of waiting. I'm not going to serve like this. Can I just simply point out that later on, when the Son of David, Jesus Christ, comes about, he's going to say something about this kind of leadership. And what he's going to say is that the greatest among you will be your servant. That has some application. Dads, if we're the leader, the head, the guy who's in charge, do you know what we've been called to? Service. Gopher. Go get this. Go do this. You serve people. By the way, elders, what's your job description? Now, I could say something to all of us as members of this church about our elders, and I could say that we've been told to honor them and obey them and treat them as the leaders they should be and let them do what they do with joy and not in a grievous way. But you know what those elders have been called to? Serve. And be all right with it. And go to the end of their service, whether that's old age or whether that's death, having spent their life as this great position of authority, being a servant. And David was this. I can't move away from that by talking about David's great patience to wait for the time when he'd finally have the reward of being king. By the way, I'll say this one thing. And I guess it's speculative, but I'm going to ask you. Do you think if you were to ask David about the happiest time of his life, what might it have been? As he got old and looked back at his life and his journey as king, do you suppose that some of the glory years and the years where he felt like he was doing the most and the years where he knew who he was might have been these years? Before all the trouble came, before all the headaches came, before he began to mess up because of his position of authority and everybody telling him how great he was, when he stayed humble, things went well. And I have a feeling that these were good years for David. Let's continue on in the story. Look at verse 20. So David arose early in the morning and left the flock with a keeper and took the supplies and went as Jesse had commanded him. And he came to the circle of the camp while the army was going out in battle array, shouting the war cry. By the way, don't you find that funny? That every day Israel still got suited up and still went out to the battle line and started yelling things like, hey, you can't take us, we're Israel. And then Goliath would walk forward for the last 40 days and stand there and say, all right, send somebody out. And everybody would go, no thanks. I mean, that's just how people are sometimes. Verse 21. Israel and the Philistines drew up in battle array, army against army. Then David left his baggage in the care of the baggage keeper and ran to the battle line and entered in order to greet his brothers. They're not in camp at the tents. They're on the battle line. And David, this kid, goes running in without any armor, without any weaponry. You know, he could have got swept up in a battle for all he knew. But he goes to where his brothers are. And look at verse 23. I think this is interesting. It says, As he was talking with them, behold, the champion, the Philistine from Gath named Goliath, was coming up from the army of the Philistines, and he spoke these same words, and David heard them. David's talking to his brothers, and if everything about the story earlier was the same, Goliath walks out to the battle line and begins to yell out, "Hey, who's going to come take me? I defy Israel. I am here to defeat you. But if you guys come fight me and you win, we'll be your servants." David hears it. You imagine if his back was turned, he turned to look at this guy. That must have been a strange scene, I guess. Verse 24 would have been even stranger. "When all the men of Israel saw the man, they fled from him and were greatly afraid. The men of Israel said, 'Have you seen this man who is coming up? Surely he is coming up to defy Israel, and it will be that the king will enrich the man who kills him with great riches and will give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel.' Then David spoke to the men who were standing by him, saying, 'What will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should taunt the armies of the living God?' The people answered him in accord with this word, saying, 'Thus it will be done for the man who kills him.'" Now Eliab, I'm going to stop there for just a moment. Let's read three more verses. "Now Eliab, his oldest brother, heard when he spoke to the men. And Eliab's anger burned against David, and he said, 'Why have you come down? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your insolence and the wickedness of your heart, for you have come down in order to see the battle.' But David said, 'What have I done now? Was it not just a question?' Then he turned away from him to another and said the same thing, and the people answered the same thing as before." All right, here's what happens. The Philistine comes out to the battle line, which is where they are, and the men all back up and run away, flee from him, and gather in little groups, and they don't say this to David, they say this to each other, and David overhears it, but they're trying to motivate each other. Did you catch that? "Hey, look, there's that champion again, and you know what? Do you remember Saul said that whoever beats him will become rich, will marry his daughter, and will be very important in the kingdom?" And so Cody Ward and John Schwartz were out on the battlefield, and Cody said, "So John, go get rich, man." And John said, "No, you go get rich. Tell you what, you know, if you can do it, you know, we'll split it. How about that? And if you don't, can I have your armor, by the way?" Like, they're having these discussions. David overhears it. And he says, "Hey, what was that again? What's going to be done for the guy who does this?" And they tell him. Now, I think this is interesting. Can you imagine this? Those of you that are older brothers or older siblings and you have a younger sibling that's started causing trouble. Eliab gets mad. And he basically says to David, "David, where's your sheep? You nothing shepherd boy. What are you doing out here on the battle line anyway?" And he actually insults him and says some things about him. And he says, "You're just here to come out here and watch us all fight. You don't have any courage. Quit asking your questions." You know what I think's going on here? I bet you Eliab knew the faith of David. I bet you he knew something about this kid. And he's starting to get uncomfortable around his army buddies, because this pipsqueak kid brother of his is showing more courage than him. Did you know, and you do know this, don't you, that when your faith shows up somebody else's faith, people get upset about that. If you doubt that, next time you're in your workplace and things are falling apart and you stand on your principles and you do right and you don't lose it, just don't be surprised if other people around you who have talked about their faith and are falling apart and losing it and not being the character that they said they should have been, just don't be surprised if they begin to say things about you and get upset about that. And I like David's response. "What did I do now? I just asked a question. Have you ever had that happen, by the way? Have you ever, in a conversation, wanted to do the right thing or point out the right thing or help somebody gain courage? And so you ask them some questions about their life. And they begin to get upset at you. Why are you saying that? Why are you always preaching at me? Why are you always... And your response is, I was just asking a question. All right. You're seeing David think, aren't you, about this? Now he goes to Saul, verse 31. Look at verse 31. When the words which David spoke were heard, they told them to Saul, and he sent for him. And David said to Saul, "Let no man's heart fail on account of him. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine." Then Saul said to David, "You are not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for you are but a youth, while he has been a warrior from his youth." But David said to Saul, "Your servant was tending his father's sheep when a lion or a bear came and took a lamb from the flock. I went out after him and attacked him and rescued it from his mouth. And when he rose up against me, I seized him by his beard and struck him and killed him. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear. And this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, since he has taunted the armies of the living God." And David said, "The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine." And Saul said to David, "Go, and may the Lord be with you." Stop there if you would. Look back at verse 31 and 32. Saul calls David in. And David, I think this is somewhat shameful, isn't it? That David, this kid, says to the king of Israel, "Let not anybody be afraid. Don't let anybody be afraid. Saul, stand up and show some courage. Remember who we are and remember who he is. But if you're afraid, I'm telling you, I'll go fight him." And Saul says, just like any good king would, right? "You can't do that, David." Now think about the arrogance of that. And by the way, do you think we've ever done that to somebody who's got faith? Do you think we've ever said to somebody who was zealous and excited and knew what they could do in the Lord and knew what the Lord could do through them and began to talk about their plans and begin to say that there were things that could be accomplished and begin to talk about the people they could reach, and we discourage them by saying things like, "You know, you can't do that. Those people know more than you. They've been studying all those years. That biology teacher in your college classroom, he'll mop the floor with you if you try to bring up something in that classroom. But I trust that God's right, and I think I could say, no, 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 don't do that." And you know what that is? That is not care or concern for that one. That's fear and insecurity and failure speaking. And I've done that a number of times. Well, the only real leader in this is David, because real leaders do not hide behind other people's fears, other people's laziness, other people's complaints. Real leaders lead. I want you to notice verse 35. David's response to Saul is it a good argument or a bad argument? Saul says, "You can't do this." And David says, "Yeah, I can. I've killed a lion and a bear by God's strength. I've done it. I was perhaps scared. There was this stuff going on, but I've killed a lion and a bear." Now, if I'm Saul, let me tell you how the argument would have gone. "Well, you know what? I bet it was a cub. And, you know, it probably was like a sick lion. And I just have to tell you that a lion and a bear are totally different than a 9'6" guy wearing armor with a spear who's trained to kill you. It's different. They aren't smart like you. He is. In fact, he's smarter." There's something interesting about this whole thing, is that David's faith grew because of victories of faith. And that's how it works for us, by the way. When we finally trust God to do the right thing, when we act encouraged to do something that we're afraid to do, we stand up and say the right thing. We make the right choice about this thing or that thing or this relationship or this sin. When we do it and God shows us that He was right about it, then the next time it happens, we gain confidence. But I'll tell you the tricks that Satan plays. He'll always say, this new challenge is unlike the old one. This new one is greater. It's different. But people of faith understand that it had nothing to do with the challenge and everything to do with the God who defeated the challenge. And David's strength grew because he knew that it was the Lord. Look at verse 37. Let me say one more thing before we move on in the story. Accomplishment. What is accomplishment as regards faith? Is it good or is it bad? How would you answer? I talk with people all the time that talk about successful things they've done in their life, things they've overcome, habits that they've beat, things that God did for them in their life, and they talk about these successes. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? And the answer is it depends, right? Because there's been times in my life when I've looked back at all of the successes and begin to grow bold in my strength, and I've thought that I've done a bunch of great things. David wasn't like that. Now, David has a strange kind of confidence, but it's because he knew that God had accomplished it, and that was clear to him. Accomplishment can either build self-trust and self-confidence, or it can build trust in God and confidence in God. And we need to make sure that we're discerning what we learn the right way. Let's go to verse 38 and talk about the battle. Then Saul clothed David with his garments and put a bronze helmet on his head, and he clothed him with armor. David girded his sword over his armor and tried to walk, for he had not tested them. So David said to Saul, I cannot go with these, for I have not tested them. And David took them off. He took his stick in his hand and chose for himself 5 smooth stones from the brook and put them in the shepherd's bag, which he had, even in his pouch. And his sling was in his hand, and he approached the Philistine. Then the Philistine came on and approached David with the shield bearer in front of him. When the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth and ruddy with a handsome appearance. The Philistine said to David, am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. The Philistine also said to David, come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the sky and the beasts of the field. Then David said to the Philistine, you come to me with a sword, a spear, and a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have taunted. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hands, and I will strike you down and remove your head from you, and I will give the dead bodies of the armies of the Philistines this day to the birds of the sky and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, and that all this assembly may know that the Lord does not deliver by sword or by spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and He will give you into our hands. Then it happened when the Philistine rose and came and drew near to meet David, that David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet the Philistine. And David put his hand into his bag and took from it a stone and slung it and struck the Philistine on his forehead. And the stone sank into his forehead, so that he fell on his face to the ground. Thus, David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone, and he struck the Philistine and killed him, but there was no sword in David's hand. Then David ran and stood over the Philistine and took his sword and drew it out of his sheath and killed him and cut off his head with it. When the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. Stop there. There's a bunch of things about that story that we know, we've seen, we've talked about. I just want to make a couple of observations to end our lesson. I have a question, first of all. In verse 40, if David's so confident, and if David's so sure of himself, why did he choose five stones? I mean, come on, David, if you're going to put your money where your mouth is, just take one. Right? What do we learn from that? Maybe it is just a practical lesson, like faith doesn't preclude preparation. Now, don't be stupid, right? You can talk all day long about how you believe God's going to take care of you and how God's going to make sure that everything's fine in your future, but don't sit on the couch and look for a job and not look for a job. But don't be wise enough to get insurance when you need insurance. Don't think that we're going to just somehow neglect our part of preparation and wisdom and expect that God's just always going to work a miracle for us. That's foolishness, not faith. And maybe that's why David chose five stones. I heard somebody say one time the other reason he chose five stones is that Goliath had four brothers. You know, I've looked everywhere in Scripture. I cannot find that. In 1 Chronicles 20, he has at least one brother. And there were some other large men in the Philistine camp that are talked about in chapter 20. But I'll give you my take, is that maybe Goliath's brother in 1 Chronicles 20 was the next champion. And maybe there were three others standing in line, and David knew that all five of them were there, and wasn't sure how the Philistines would react to the fallen giant. But if the other four came, David would be ready. You know, I want you to notice verses 46 and 47. David sees this as a teaching opportunity. I don't know that I would have said much because I would have been shaking and scared. I would have been trying to figure out how to get as quickly this thing over with as possible. But when I see the giant walking out to me and he says to me, even more annoyed than he was before because I've now insulted him by not wearing armor and I've insulted him by only carrying a stick and a sling. And he says, what am I, a dog? Who do you think you are? I'm going to feed you to the birds today. You are a dead man. David says what he needs to say. He has this weird like pregame talk. It's like boxers when they're interviewed before the match and one of them says, oh yeah, I'm going to win. You see what happens when we get in the ring. And then they interview the other guy. And you ever seen that other guy who says, well, I'm just going to go in there and I'm going to fight. I'm going to do what I do. I'd expect that maybe from David. That David might just say, you know, we'll see after this is done who's left standing. But he doesn't do that. He says very clearly, God will do this. And you, Goliath, are a dead man. In fact, here's how it's going to look. I'll kill you and I'll cut off your head. And then everybody's going to run away. In fact, that made Goliath so mad that he began to move toward David. Now, I want you to notice what David does when Goliath moves toward him. Verse 48. It said that David ran, how? Quickly. Toward him. Verse 24 says, everybody else ran away from him. David ran toward him as fast as he could. And by the way, remember that valley I told you about that was rocky and hard to navigate? I've heard people suggest that God's strength was so with David, and there was so much power in what God was doing through David, that his strength was not really to be understood, that he could run as quickly as he could in such a place as this. I don't know if that's right. David has strange confidence. It is. It's strange. It's otherworldly. It makes no sense. It's not logical. And here's the reasons, and here's the lesson that I want to leave you with. Every time somebody tried to talk to David about how stupid this was, they were right. They all saw the problem here. He's tall, you're small. He's experienced, you are not. He has a javelin, you've got a stick. And every single time, David was unmoved by the argument. And you almost look at it and you say, come on, let's be honest here. This is silly. This makes no sense. And if I'd have been standing there, and if you'd have been standing there, and it was your brother or your boy going out to meet the giant, you tell me what you'd say. Don't do it. Do you know what was different about David? Chapter 16, verse 7 was what was different about David. David knew God, and he knew that God was not the kind of God who saw the externals of a situation, but the internal. David, a man after God's own heart, could see the unseen. That's always what faith does. It's able to see things that other people don't see. And I want to show you the contrast in chapter 17. Look at verse 25. 17:25 says that the Israelites were saying these words. The men of Israel said, "Have you seen this man who is coming up? Surely he is coming up to defy Israel." You see that? That's what they were saying. This one is defying Israel. Now look at what David said in verse 26. Then David spoke to the men who were standing by him, saying, "What will be done for this man who kills the Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should taunt Israel?" Listen to how David says it. Who's this guy that should taunt the armies of the living God? That's how David talked. That's how David thought. It's different. And when Goliath points out the weapon difference, you've got sticks, I've got armor, David doesn't, he recognizes that. He says, sure, you've got a sword and a javelin and a shield, you've got all of that, but I'll tell you what I've got the Word of God. And for most everybody else looking at the situation, it makes no sense, but to a person who walks by faith and not by sight, it makes perfect sense. David lived in a spiritual realm where God was bigger than the enemy. God was stronger than the threat. God was on the side of truth and his people who stood for truth. What's the lesson for you? What's your giant? What is it? Maybe there's somebody sitting here this morning that has never been able to figure out how to get over hatred. Never. Something happened to you when you were young, and since then you have hated somebody or a group of somebodies because of the color of their skin or because of their gender or because of who they were in your family. Maybe you've always hated, and whatever you've tried and whatever you've done, that battle will not go away, and every time you fled from it and it's beat you. Maybe you're sitting here this morning and you've not figured out how to get off drugs or stop drinking yourself into some better feeling each night. Maybe your giant is immorality. Some point in your life, it gripped you, it got a hold of you, you know what it feels like, and you can't walk away from it when you're in a situation that you know you shouldn't be. And that girl you're dating, or that boy that you're dating, and that temptation that's ever before you, and you can't seem to get a hold of it, that's your giant. And some of the measures it would take to defeat it seem drastic. They seem strange, that you might have to run away from that temptation, or that you may need to meet it head on with words of courage that say, this is what is right, and this is who I'll be. Maybe your giant's just doubt. You're just not sure that if you make the decision today to follow the Lord like it was meant to be done, that God's going to work it out, that it really won't happen like you think. You know, every one of us faces the giant of sin, the guilt of our life. And the fact that not only do we got to get rid of everything that's been on, gone on in our past and deal with that, we've got to deal with a Satan who will constantly challenge us, stand before us as a roaring lion. Or call out to us like he's Goliath, so armed and so dangerous and so strong and so equipped that he's going to always make us run away, or one of these days we're going to learn our lesson. And we're going to say, God can do this. But I gotta walk out there. And I gotta fill my pouch. And I've gotta close my eyes and see it right. I've gotta see it the right way. And I gotta run to meet it. Please do that. I'm thinking to some of you. Please, for the Lord's sake. It's his reputation. It's not just yours. It's that when it's finally done, people will not just walk away saying how great David is. They'll walk away saying how great God is. Let him do it today. Let's stand and sing, and if you need us, come forward.